keep focusing on the cult leader, the cult leader is nothing without followers, right? I mean, that's what's so interesting. Like the one about Rajneesh, who was the Indian guy that had 100 Rolls Royces and they lived up in Oregon somewhere, right? Yeah. It's they interviewed people today, and these people still have this sense of longing, love, and wonder, and just awesome devotion to this moron. I mean, it's still there. They're still inside of those feelings, right? And so it's the followers that, to me, are what's interesting to actually look at.
This time, in part two of our Cults and Conspiracy special, John and Scoop are joined in the virtual studio by Bijoy Goswami and Rob Matney. We discuss cults, their methods, their followers, and their motives. Later, Guru Bijoy and Guru John debate the differences between Buddhism and the scientific method. No animals were harmed during the debate, but several feathers were ruffled.
Hey, everybody. This is John Lepkoski, Plutopia News Network, here with Scoop Sweeney, my partner in crime, and our guest today, two guests. One is Bijoy Goswami, who is a steward of meaning models and a strategist and a consultant. And the other is Robert Matney, who is managing director of government affairs for Yonder. And these are also guys that have been part of the Austin intelligentsia for some years. And we are now going to become pundits. And as a first step to becoming pundits, I will suggest that we consider how we will start our cult of punditry. Because it's not enough to be a pundit anymore. You have to build a cult around it. So how do we go about doing that? Who's going to be Q in our cult?
This is an enjoyably, impishly provocative framing, especially given that we're talking to Bijoy, who definitely takes every opportunity to push back against guru culture. So I'm enjoying where we're starting.
Bijoy, I know. Bijoy enjoys being a guru who denies being a guru.
Well, I have an entire IMDb list that's the title of which is Consider Me Gone. In an homage to the Sting song, and it contains just about every single documentary about cults of all kinds, including Rajneesh and all of them. So we can certainly go down that conversation.
I invite you to share that with me, and maybe we should post it on the site.
Oh, absolutely. We should all. I mean, we have. We have so many, and so many through history, and so many that are active today. So
I can think of one active today, and he was very active today with his cult, reminding us that it's all a hoax.
That's right. Actually, you know, it's that was interesting. I know we continue to go to that conversation or that particular topic, but when we had this person assume the presidency, to me it was an indication of, okay, well, so, you know, let's see what this is, a something coming from the American population and something's happening, so let's see what happens. And then I kind of put it aside in the sense that you've got to let things unfold, and then the last little while it's been a return back to understanding the psyche and psychology of this individual. And, you know, there's been very interesting things where this book came out, as recently coming out, I guess this week, about his dad and all that, and the history of that entire family, by the niece. And yeah, there's a really great article about a couple of great articles, one on Politico and one on the other one about Norman Vincent Peale, who was the pastor for the dad and the son. And then you've got Roy Cohn. So essentially, if you think about these three entities, Fred, Norman, and Roy, and you realize that these are the three inputs that created the internal construct for this individual, it all just makes sense. Like, it all actually makes total sense. Because Norman Vincent Peale was the promoter of a cult of positive thinking. And he was, it was very interesting because he was a pastor, but couldn't help his congregation very much. And so through the depression in the early, I guess, early 30s. And so his wife suggested that he go meet a psychologist. And then they kind of combined Freudian psychology and Christianity. And then sort of this idea that you can manifest and make real anything that you thought about positively. And it's just sort of this, you know, the birthplace of modern American gurus actually would be Norman Vincent Peale, and just making up random stuff. But it's really literally this idea that you can, if you will it and if you think it, it will be true, right? Roy Cohn is the, if someone punches you, punch them back 15 times harder, right? And Fred Trump is the racist white supremacist who believe they're winners and losers. And so you get this holy trifecta that have shaped this individual and his entire journey. And then you kind of, if you understand those three inputs, you're like, oh, okay, it all makes sense.
You know that thing about if you think it and speak it, you can make it real. That's kind mm-hmm. of an occult idea, isn't it? Isn't that what magic's all about?
Total cult idea. Yes.
So Norman Vincent Peale is really a warlock, right?
That's right.
I love this topic for digging into. I remember growing up, my grandmother being interested in Robert Schuller, a minister who was in California. I don't remember if there was an affiliated denomination within the Christian church that he was a part of, but he had a massive church. I think it was kind of the first mega church that term didn't really exist then, but it was called the Crystal Cathedral. And there was a lot about kind of framing your mind in a way that was kind of godly and that would manifest things outside of you, you know? And I don't want to necessarily ascribe to him or his beliefs some of what kind of comes to be with the prosperity gospel, but it does seem to me like it was a step in that direction, right? Where we have this, like, one, this cultural obsession with money, of course, and financial achievement as a mode of expressing status, but we also have inherited this either conscious or non-conscious Calvinist sense of predestination, where, like, if mm-hmm. you're good, it's not that it somehow will facilitate your afterlife in the way that you want, but rather it's a sign of favor. If you have a predilection to be good, it's because you're predestined to go to the place that you want to go to when life is over. And when you marry those two, then you're at least easily left with the possibility that financial success is a mark of the Lord's favor. And so therefore anything that you do to secure money is sort of predestined, and your success is a sign that actually you're on a divine path. And this is one hell of a toxic stew, right? We find ourselves.
Oh, yeah, totally. I mean, and it's even worse than that, because it's you're, I mean, the other thing that Norman Vincent Peale did was he actually sort of said that the Bible is scientific, right? So how do you contend with the fact that science is a totally separate process by which you understand things about the world? He just started claiming that the Bible is the most scientific thing. And so you have this fascinating co-opting of that, right? So you can manifest. So not only is the abundance piece you're the sign that you're successful, but you should actually go after it. So now you've got Christianity and capitalism coming together to form, you know, the mindset and worldview of individuals, right? And because I think that's the piece that I think is so interesting about all of this is that if you think about, I've just been going down this rabbit hole around The Great Gatsby and Moby Dick, which I think we've had some discussion about privately, but in both of those, there's this idea of the in Moby Dick, it's the gold bullion that is used to, that everybody look at the doubloon, yeah, that Ahab puts up and everybody looks at it and they all keep seeing their reflection in it, but they don't really see their own journey. And in Gatsby, it's the spectacles of T.J. Eckelberg, the optometrist that looms over the whole scene in the Valley of the Ashes, right? But to me, like, it's interesting because this is just a reflection of some of the dark psyche of the American journey, right? And what's still toxic and inside the American, like the susceptibility to the P.T. Barnum and the huckster. The Ponzi scheme is an American thing. That was a guy who was American, right? I mean, not that Ponzi schemes haven't been committed in the rest of the world, but Americans, we are uniquely susceptible to capitalists and gold rush and make money fast and all of this kind of thing, right? So it's like this person represents a mirror back to America's deepest, darkest issues. And sure enough, they've all sort of arisen too, right? I mean, they've arisen from... we've got Black Lives Matter, which is the white supremacist history of the country. You've got Me Too that has emerged again on this conversation about women's role. You've got a fake business person who's actually lost more money than he's ever made, as touted as the paragon of success. I mean, it's just that part to me is what's interesting, because if we keep focusing on the cult leader. The cult leader, it is nothing without followers, right? I mean, that's what's so interesting. Like the one about Rajneesh, who was the Indian guy that had 100 Rolls Royces and they lived up in Oregon somewhere, right? Yeah. It's they interviewed people today, and these people still have this sense of longing, love, and wonder, and just awesome devotion to this moron. I mean, it's still there. They're still inside of those feelings, right? And so it's the followers that, to me, are what's interesting to actually look at.
Yeah, absolutely. And you kind of wonder what it is in those guys. I mean, it's obviously what we call charisma, but really, what is charisma? How does that magnetism work? How does a Jim Jones get a bunch of people to drink poison? You know, how does somebody like Mel Lyman, the Boston Avatar guy, get those people to not just follow him, but also go out and beat people up for him, you know?
You know, I had an interesting experience with a, maybe not a guru. Anyone remember Est? Erhard's seminar training. Back in my journalism days, I attended an Est gathering of the tribes, I guess, or gathering of the suckers. And went in, I fibbed a little bit about my background. I didn't tell them I was a journalist. And I really didn't get a thing out of all the lecturing because I was busy watching what was going on in the audience. And there were just all these true believers just circulating and taking people aside that looked fairly well-dressed and moneyed, perhaps. And taking the side and giving them the real hardcore, you got to join. It's all going to make you better. And they got me because I came in. I wore a nice suit and I had my hair all tied back. So I looked fairly good for a San Francisco Bay Area, normal guy, normal-ish for me. And it was just
you get, right?
It was just amazing. And they grabbed me and they're like, well, what do you do? How much do you make? It's like a job interview and they really want to know how much you make. And I just kind of gave them vague answers. And unfortunately, I gave them my real name and they found me later on, and these guys showed up at my home saying, well, we heard you were at the seminar, and we just wanted to follow up. It was just frightening, and they apparently did that a lot.
Well, I had an encounter with Est, and it's probably a longer story than I would want to tell, but I did have an insight about Est and Werner Erhard. I mean, this is a guy who had gone to like motivational trainings and stuff and had done a lot of sales training and learned how to sell to people. And I think Est was just like this idea that you didn't have to have a product to be able to sell something to people. You could sell them an idea, or you could sell them a vibe, And I think Est was about that. I mean, it was supposedly about sort of getting to your best self. But, man, it was, there was some intricate bullshit there. There really was.
Well, the other piece of this is that, you know, there, we were talking about an evolutionary brain that is very, very long on groups of 150, right? Community belonging of 200, 150 to 200. So in the modern world where you have that sort of, you know, if you can go find that community, that was the funniest thing when I got the call from Landmark Forum friends who, this is years ago, and I've had the most wonderful experience and I really want you to be part of it. And yeah. We had the same thing with the Tony Robbins seminar once as well. But so I, you know, at that point I was like, all right, I'll just go sample this. And it was fascinating to watch as the sales pitch crumbled, right? You start with all the cool things that's going to happen. You're like, well, I'm already good there. I'm good there. And finally the sales pitch was, but this great community that we have, right? So if you can join a set of people who share the same construct as you or are going after the same thing. And I think that's what's so interesting is that people, these folks tap into those things that we really need, and we're bioengineered by evolution to want, right? And we don't have in the modern world, we don't have these close-knit communities where we know. So we've got to actually create our own community. But then this person says, don't worry, I've got a built-in community for you. And it's really nice to be part of that, right? So that's certainly one piece of the puzzle. I think the other piece is like this part of the human brain that is devoted to magical thinking because of the complexity of reality. So a magical story will act as a sedative to, you know, have us not want to question. We've got a nice answer for that, right? It's the certainty of knowing versus the uncertainty of being in the question.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like an awful lot can be explained by people running as hard and as fast as they can from their own existential dread with which they're unwilling to reckon, you know, and just mm-hmm. any kind of certainty in a world of infinite ambiguity is such a deep comfort that you can reach to absurd conclusions and absurd platitudes in order to run from that fear.
Yeah, I mean, like when I went down the rabbit hole on the U.S.'s journey and as the inventor and the you know, first place where democracy really took hold. If you people think of the Greeks did it, but sure. But like in the modern world, I mean, real democracy that's scalable. And the big insight that they had was that this thing is not fixed, right? That this is not a constitution, but a constitutioning. That we have processes by which you can change the document, you can amend the laws, and they built that right in. That was, to me, the big innovation. And yet today you have, including, you know, people like Scalia on the Supreme Court, who are these originalists, and it's like, no, it was exactly as the founders intended. Well, okay, so they intended slavery, so we shouldn't get rid of that. They intended women weren't given the vote, so we should stick with that. I mean, so, you know, right? So even today you have this need for certainty, despite the fact that we live inside of systems that say no model is sacred. Like we get to update our models of the world or our laws, or we get to update, you know, all this stuff, but people are still, you know, clinging to no, this is how it was supposed to be, this is how it is, this is the thing I'm going to be assured of, right?
Yeah, for sure. And I had a marvelous course when I was at university under Professor Jeffrey Tulis, who has written a few amazing books, including The Rhetorical Presidency. But he really framed, and the focus was, on the Enlightenment into and through the founding documents, inclusive of the, you know, the Federalist Papers, et cetera. And he's a really incisive teacher, and he really framed the Constitution as the question of how we are constituting ourselves, and his praise of the discussion around that Constitution, including how can we ensure that the people are able to constitute and reconstitute themselves over time. Once you give some time to a thing, so often it can just become calcified, right? And then it becomes something that doctrinal originalists can hang their hat on, right? But the absurdity of the doctrinal originalist is that the original doctrine explicitly embraced change.
I mean, take the critique of Fauci that's happening right now. Oh, he said things that were not that we know are not true, but that's the whole point. Science is trying to figure things out as we go, and so we're going to keep updating our knowledge and share the new knowledge. But instead of that being the conversation, it's oh, he said one statement that isn't the right statement or at that time, right? So it's back to the same kind of notion that our models are fixed or all these things are held in stone, rather than the fact that all of these things are evolving. I mean, it's the same thing that people use the Bible. I mean, I just find it laughable that people will use the Bible or any quote unquote sacred document as some kind of fixed understanding or absolute understanding of anything, right? Especially that most of those documents were written by pre-scientific people who had no idea like about 99.9% of the things we know about regarding the world, right? Because that to me has been really revealing, is the sheer utter lack of scientific thinking in our society, right? I mean, the other, like the fact that you can have political debates about things is one issue, which is valid, but the fact that you can debate actual facts about the world and how you get those facts, that to me has been a real revelation. Maybe I just have been naive about that, but it's like, wow, how can you have political debates about facts?
I don't know that you were naive about it. I think maybe you just lacked exposure. I think the same was true of me. You know, we've probably been in bubbles to a greater extent than we realized. And we didn't see a lot of the kinds of conversations that go on because they were hidden from us, because there was no mechanism for them to reach us. But now with social media, anybody can like publish whatever crazy thought they may be having at any given time. And suddenly you're seeing into people's heads like you never could before. And realizing that people have some really, really crazy ideas, and that there are so many people who are just not like you, and there are so many people who really can't adhere to anything like the scientific method. They're superstitious, or they're, you know, their minds just kind of don't go there. The way that they build meaning for themselves is so radically different from the way that you and I might do it. And to me, the difficulty is, I have an aversion to all that stuff, you know, so I'm wanting to push it away. But I also understand, you know, like from the Buddhist perspective, that aversion is a problem. You know, aversion is just sort of like the other end of attachment. And that what I would like to learn to do is to be more receptive to all of that stuff and really try to understand what those people are trying to tell me and what meaning they're seeing. But, you know, I mean, it hits me. I'm in debates on Facebook with people who are making sometimes absurd and sometimes really more nuanced, but I believe incorrect contentions about COVID-19. And there's a lot of misinformation about COVID-19 out there. And I have convinced myself that I have the right information, of course, and that some of these other people who are posting different thoughts have the wrong information. And I have to question myself there, you know, do I really have the right information? I do sometimes like just step up and say, well, nope, you're wrong. This is the way it is. And I'm trying really more to be sort of like, well, that's an interesting thought, but you know, this is what I'm seeing.
But I think that's what I think is so fascinating, is that we are, you know, it's a constant exposure, right? To like, for example, like let's take the Black Lives Matter, the reemergence of that, and that's been around for some time, but just this reemergence of it caused me to go back and look even more deeply at my understanding of the history of slavery and civil rights and you know, Reconstruction and Jim Crow, and I mean, just the whole story, right? And from this point of like this place of a renewed perspective, you get an even deeper understanding, right? And do I have the full understanding? No, not at all. But it's that I believe that I can continue to deepen my understanding in any area of life, and that I'm committed to that, right? That's, I think, the underlying thing that folks aren't committed to, but I think it's also because they weren't taught that. And I think this, to me, has revealed the real failings of education. We teach people the fruits of education, the fruits of the scientific method. So, you know, they get the snapshot of reality based on what science knew, which whatever part of science had gotten to the textbooks, right? Let's just say that, right? So like fixed knowledge about XYZ. And then instead of going, oh, I need to continually update my models because science is continuing to update its models, people stop actually, or don't have an internal process, or aren't even taught that they should continually update their models or their, you know, their understanding of all these things, right?
Oh, yeah, that's a great point. We're taught to think in terms of fixed knowledge, and we come to believe through our process of going through school that all of these facts that are being poured into us are static, and that they're fixed, and that they are correct. You know, the facts are the facts. And what you learn, if you start looking at it from a more, let's say, realistic perspective, you find that facts are pretty subjective, and that often the things that were presented to you as facts are more like consensus. They're not necessarily what was real, but they're what the consensus about what was real. So a consensus formed that this is the narrative that we're going to present to people. So, you know, the narrative about the founding of the U.S. is that Columbus discovered America, as though nobody else had been here before, as though nobody else was already living here, but he discovered it. You know, that's a very Eurocentric perception, that some guy from Europe came to the United States and discovered it. And if you're actually in the United States, it would make sense to have a narrative that says, well, you know, Native Americans were here for thousands of years, and then suddenly this guy showed up, and he was kind of uncouth, you know, and he planted a flag and said he discovered the place. And we thought, well, that's pretty silly. We were here. You know, but we don't get that narrative. We get the Columbus discovered America narrative.
Yeah, the narrative taught in Texas schools, I could speak from the experience of being a real fan of, I loved studying history in school. And the history taught in my high school in West Texas, the same one John went to, was the history of slavery and the Civil War and what all that meant was completely different from what I learned when I went to the University of North Texas and had a very progressive person teaching the reality of those things. And I was very confused for a while. It's like, you mean they were lying to me in high school? And I don't know if it's so much lying, but the books they gave you only covered what the people in the power structure wanted to be taught. And that continues on today. If you look at the Texas Education Association, they would dearly love to teach those old values and not the real ones.
Though it could be that that new understanding that you had from the class that you had at North Texas was also based on an incorrect narrative. And one of my understandings about science is that in science, you don't commit 100% to a particular theory or narrative, but that you will hold one as, you know, it's a hypothetical. So you have a hypothetical and you find a lot of evidence for it. So you say, well, this is what we think is true. This is what we think is really happening. But you always hold out the possibility that some other information is going to come in, or some other insight or understanding that will lead you to question whether you had it right in the first place. And that's kind of what Bejoy is talking about. It's a dynamic thing, and it's an evolving thing.
It's the truth du jour, then.
There you go.
Well, but it's right. And so the thing that the it's a very, very high bar when people say something is just a theory, they're really misusing that word, because a theory has been rigorously checked with this. It started off as a hypothesis, right? I mean, a hypothetical model. And then it went through the scientific method, right? Experiment, review, And then it came out as a robust theory, but that does not mean that that theory is not then modified. I mean, that what science is continually doing is, it's not like, for example, that Einstein dismissed Newton. Newton gave us a model of gravity that, that, for example, took from Galileo, right? And took Galileo gave us a terrestrial model of gravity. He said, oh, by the way, objects operate in this way on planet Earth. And Newton said, okay, but not just Earth, but also the moon and the stars. And Einstein comes in and updates that, right? And says, oh, space and time can be considered one. So each of these are models that continually update themselves and become even more precise and more refined than the previous iterations of those previous models, right? And so, like, even that, even in how we tell science, we talk about Einstein, like he had some insight. No, he just was a great practitioner of the scientific model, and or the scientific method, and gave us a particular set model. And Einstein also, by the way, missed the subatomic in the second half of his journey. He missed the entire subatomic, field because he didn't. Because what he saw there scared him, right? That's his famous phrase about God didn't play dice plus, with the universe. But stuff that's happening in the subatomic world does not operate in the same way that stuff happens in, the mass scalar world. But a person like Einstein, who was brilliant as he was, couldn't get there himself personally. But the beauty of science is it doesn't hinge on any one person. It hinges on this process continually working itself through, right? So, but I think that's the piece that is this really, really important piece, because if you live in this uncertainty, and I don't just mean like about the world outside, but about yourself, right? So the distinction I make with the phenomena piece or what science gives us is an understanding of the world, but the meaning bit is an understanding of our own internal world, right? And those two things are really different things. How I choose to operate my personal life in some aspect, science can't tell me whether I should be in a monogamous relationship or not have a relationship or have many, or what, or how to structure my, it can give me some models, some suggestions or some observations about that, but I've got to go and figure out my personal journey with that, right? And I think that's where the conflict comes in, is that people are continually, we're faced with this problem. We want a hammer that's going to give us all the answers. I see people who, for example, believe in science to the exclusion of everything else. And that's a problem too, right? Because, for example, if we get into the political realm, science can inform us. So, for example, we know that climate change is, you use science, climate change is happening. But how do we prioritize climate change? Is it a problem we need to deal with now or later? That's not a question of phenomena. That's a question of the political debate and the rights conversation, right? And we have to negotiate that versus... We don't negotiate whether climate change is true or not. That's not, science is not negotiation, it's evidence-based, right? But in the political sphere, we do have to negotiate, right? And so I think this is the other problem, is the human mind wants to find the golden hammer that gives it one answer, right? And the difficulty is, like, actually we don't have one hammer, we have multiple hammers, and you have to use the right hammer, the right tool for the right situation. And that, to me, is what causes so much of the consternation and the reversion back to somebody just give me a simple answer.
I think one of the things I hear in the point you're making, Bijoy, is that truth may be emergent and evolving, and this may terrify people, and it may, and these are my words, not yours, it may encourage them to retreat into doctrinal orthodoxy of one flavor or another. Or some new emergent cultish orthodoxy, but some sort of thing that pretends to have the answers.
Yeah.
But while the truth may be emergent and discoverable and iterative, it is so through the rubric of disciplined, diligent application of a method, in this case, the scientific method. And the difficulty is it's hard to say, listen, we've torn down the hegemonic god of truth, but we haven't replaced it with nothing. Your thoughts and feelings do not therefore constitute truth, except insofar as the subject is your internal truth and feelings. But there is a process for with diligence getting to externalities, and we need to trust that process, potentially improve that process, but certainly use the process over and over again.
Yes, and that's the problem, is that people can be beneficiaries of, let's say, the scientific method. All of us are beneficiaries of the scientific method. I mean, just every object you touch is somehow because of our mastery of electricity or some other, you know, fundamental force. But you can be a beneficiary and not, and actually dismiss it. This is what to me is fascinating about, in a pre-scientific world, right? You're like, oh my gosh, I understand so little. And so the Enlightenment and all of that was such a revelatory moment, because they could use this method over and over again and keep discovering truths about the universe that in the last 300 years, 99% of what we know comes from that scientific method, right? So at that initial point, people are truly just reveling in the fact that this new method, which displaces the authority-based system, is giving them all these answers. But in our world today, as beneficiaries sitting here a couple hundred, 300 years on, you can sit here and critique science, but happily use your cell phone, right? So this is the interesting problem of, people are complacent about democracy. Like if you look at places like India or Taiwan, or where democracy came in and they were under dictatorships, 97% participation, right? I mean, or whatever, 90 plus percent of people voting and participating because they appreciate seeing this process work out versus an authority-based system. But in America, like, oh, we've been under the democracy. What's the big deal? Like, why do I bother voting, right? And so you get this interesting complacency on the other side of it, where people aren't appreciating what got them there, right? And so that to me is this issue of, if you don't know where this stuff comes from, then it's as good as you can make it up, right? And that's where we are. It's like, you can sit here with all this technology that only arises out of the scientific method and happily get on Facebook, which is the direct result of the scientific method, and tweet out your or send your crazy idea of what stuff is, right? So the piece for me that's interesting is the truth tests, which I think you've been highlighting, which is like, how do I know something's true, right? And what for me was a big insight was, oh, if I'm dealing with a particular realm, then I've got to use a different truth test, right? So like, let's just take the democratic process, for example, and people talk about inalienable rights, right? That there are inalienable rights. No, they're not, right? All rights are fundamentally negotiated. That's the sort of insight of the democratic process. Now, over time, what happens is that we go, oh, we keep coming back to that same thing as a right, and then it gets conferred as an inalienable right because we use the process over and over again, we still come back to that right. And so what's happened is the set of inalienable rights has expanded as we've used the democratic process over and over again, right? But the truth test of that is negotiation with fellow human beings in a political process to get to that truth, right? So whereas the scientific method does not rely on negotiation, the scientific method relies on presentation of evidence, right? You don't negotiate a scientific model. That's not how that works. So whereas if we just add in a third piece, it's like the truth test within the market system is a transaction, right? So if you come and say, I made this painting and you sell it to me for $50 million, and I go, yep, it's worth $50 million, and we freely transact that exchange between us, that makes it true in that realm, right? So this is the issue, is that, you know, we have multiple truth tests for how we know something is true, but it's very dependent on what domain we're speaking about, right? And I think the big sort of 20th century, 21st century problem is the meaning problem, because your meaning questions were all very simple. Like, you know, the Europeans fought for whatever, 1,000+ years about which particular flavor of Christianity, or a few hundred years, 500 years, on whether you were Calvinist or Lutheran or Catholic, right? Those were your kind of choices. But now, like with access to, you know, Buddhist texts and Islamic works and philosophers, you're like, I've got 600 of these potential first philosophies or models I can use to run my personal, you know, show, right? So you've got this conflation happening where I'm looking at this problem that I've got, let's say a crisis of meaning in my life, and I don't know how I'm supposed to get there, which which method I'm supposed to use, who am I supposed to rely on? And I think that complexity is bearing on the individual so heavily today in a way that it never has. I think no individuals have not felt that ever in human history.
Yeah, there's so many competing narratives.
Yes.
It's really hard to like zero in on one. I mean, from my perspective, you know, my approach is a Buddhist approach.
But there's, you don't take a Buddhist approach to, you don't take a Buddhist approach to the virus, right? I just want to highlight that point, right?
What would a Buddhist approach to the virus be? I mean,
well, to understanding the virus, I mean, to understanding what's happening with the virus and what is it doing. And like, just phenomenally speaking, like what is the virus? How does it operate? You're not using Buddhism to understand the virus, right?
Well, I'm trying to think about that. In a sense, yes, and in a sense, no. I mean, in a sense, like from a Buddhist perspective, what you're going to do is you're just going to be in the present and see what's in front of you, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So if I actually had the virus or encountered the virus, the Buddhist perspective might come into play there.
Absolutely. But sure. That's your personal response to the virus. Is where you're leaning on or adopting the Buddhist method or model to parse that, right? But not about how the virus is communicated and what is the virus made out of and what is its inherent structure. You're not using the Buddhist approach to understand the intrinsic nature of that thing, right? You might say, what is my response to that thing? How should I deal with that thing? Is there some kind of human journey that this thing is causing us to be exposed to? That all might be informed from the Buddhist approach. But in terms of like the actual thing itself, the virus itself, how it operates, you're not using the Buddhist approach to do that part, that bit of work for you, right?
Well, there is an understanding of you know, that everything is interdependent and interrelated, right? So
I understand the
virus as being part of the whole reality that is all interrelated and interdependent, and you have this sense that everything is connected, and the virus is part of that. I mean, you know, everything is connected to everything else.
But that is not incompatible with the scientific approach that we live in a connected universe, right?
Right.
Is absolutely the same concept. I mean, it's all one. We're breaking it down. We're breaking reality down into domains and subspecialties and so on and so forth. But and even the search for the unified theory of everything that'll kind of bring all the theories under one umbrella is underpinning the scientific sort of, right? The scientific method is saying, how is everything connected? The Buddhist thing says everything is connected. And if I take this perspective that everything is connected, then it will change the way I approach my personal existence.
Well, right? I think you would approach anything, including the virus, with a different attitude or a different understanding, you know?
Well, I
mentioned earlier the idea of aversion and attachment, you know, which are kind of two sides of the same coin. In Buddhism, there is a thought that you would not become attached to your thoughts or to your desires, you know, cravings, that sort of thing. And that you would not also have like a lot of aversions to things in the world. I mean, the virus is just the virus, you know, and your fear of the virus, if you feared the virus, that would tend to create an aversion.
Sure.
But as from a Buddhist perspective, I think that what you would try to do is just observe your fear, but you wouldn't get too attached to your fear, and hopefully you wouldn't have this powerful aversion. But that doesn't mean that you would like go out and let somebody cough in your face or something like that, you would still wear your mask and you'd still do social distancing. But your attitude would be different.
Yeah, so that's what I'm saying, is that meaning, this domain of meaning, is the emergent problem of the mid-20th century and where we are today, right? This meaning, to me, just the way I define that realm, which is different from the phenomenal realm or the political or the economic realm, that meaning piece is a subjective thing of how do I relate to the world, right? Like, science can tell me what the universe is made out of, but how do I relate to the universe? That's not a scientific question. That's a meaning question, right? How do I perceive it as one connected thing? Does it care? Is there a being that's in charge of it? Those are not things that science has anything to say about, right? So like in this example, this is great because we're kind of getting to something very tangible here. Everything you've talked about with what Buddhism helps you do, or the Buddhist approach or model helps you do, is it helps you relate to this reality that we're in, right? This both in terms of the general reality and this particular COVID-based reality, and what you're going to do around it, right? How are you going to process it, and what meaning are you going to derive from it on your own journey, right? Versus, what is this thing, right? How do I understand how its inner workings are and how it gets transmitted and you know, blah, blah, blah. That's a different domain, right? And that's what I'm saying is so interesting, is because the truth test in meaning is absolutely personal, right? Like, if I believe that I should be, you know, never get married, which I do, I don't want to be in a single relationship. I've tried some of the approaches, and I found my own particular way. There's no right answer to that, except that it's a right answer for me, right? The piece that to me is so interesting, and why gurus are so prevalent and pundits are so prevalent, is all you have to do is offer up a model for how we should deal with a particular aspect of our existence, and you're a guru. That to me is everything else we talked about is sort of second, third, fourth order. The first thing you have to do is come up with a new model for something, right? Whatever that's based on, it doesn't really matter. You have a new approach to how some aspect of human existence should be dealt with, whether it's health or spirituality or relationships or whatever, right? That's regardless of, or not really even, it might or might not use science for that, right? But even what Buddha came up with was purely based on a personal experience that he had, right? He went into the forest, he was trying to seek enlightenment, he was going down this path of asceticism, and then he realized that that path itself was flawed, right? The ascetic path failed for him, and in giving up the ascetic path, he then came to what we now call Buddhism, right? And so that's very interesting, but that's personal. That's Buddha's idea of how to parse the journey of life. And in the same way, everybody, Tony Robbins is valid, the Landmark Forum is valid. They're valid as a model, which I might or might not choose to subscribe to make my personal world work, right? But that's not, and this is where the problem happens, because in the case of meaning, there's no debate. It's not like we're going to sit here and I'm not going to say to you, John, I really think you should dump that Buddhism thing because it's dumb, right? Because I know that that's your personal meaning, right? It's not a scientific thing we're going to go find evidence for. It's not a political debate we're going to have. It's not something I'm going to sell you or buy from you. It's just the way that John wants to run his relationship with others and the universe, right? So because meaning is personal and not in the other realms, any meaning model is valid. It's just valid for you, right? The cult leader says, no, my personal meaning model, it is valid for others, and I'm going to bring them all into it and make them comply and understand and live beneath and through my meaning model, my personal model.
Actually, I think what Buddhism does is a little different, and maybe not, this is probably a path we need to go down now, but I think that Buddhism would sort of, that you would ultimately tend to put all that stuff aside and just be where you are and what you are at any given moment, and not get into models and concepts and that sort of thing. And you know, part of the,
John, if that were true, let me just push back a little bit on that. If that were true, you wouldn't have the multiple variants of Buddhism that you do. Right. See, the thing is that you can't, deny the existence of models. Everything is parsed through a model. Even saying, I have no model is a model, right? You're parsing it through some intellectual construct. Even when you say, I'm just going to be, that's a model, right? And if you look at, like, so in, for example, like Myanmar and Sri
Lanka.
Yeah,
but you, in Buddhism, you, what you're talking about is a lot of different paths that go to the same place and not exactly a lot of different. I mean, in a sense, I can see where you would say there are different models, but, you know, it's just like, depending on the culture and the environment that you're in, there's going to be a different take on how to walk down the road, you know, but eventually you walk down the road and you can reach the same destination.
I definitely get where you're going with that, John. And I think similar things can be said of other, I know it's challenging to say religious models, but similar things can be said of other religious constructs or belief sets where you can kind of aim aspirationally for the elimination of model-based thinking, right? That aspirationally you're looking for direct access. And I think that is certainly part of what's purported in Buddhism, to which I'm extremely partial, by the way. And it's also the case that cultures will manifest it because humans are humans, will manifest it in ways that become dogmatic. That I think we can all agree appears to be a human attribute. That's one point I wanted to make, which is just saying, yes, models manifest. That doesn't necessarily denude that aspirational point that I think John is making. But I also take the point, even that fundamentally is a model. And as humans, we're kind of delimited by models. Like just as
right, So this is the point that to me, it's not because humans are humans, it's because we're coming into contact with the subjective nature of meaning, right? That meaning is subjective. And so you look at every single religious system, whether we're talking about Buddhism or Islam or Christianity or Hinduism, they all have 1,000 flavors, right? Right when the founder guy goes away, then the split begins, right? So in Islam, it was either Muhammad's relative who claimed that he had the true way, and then you had Muhammad's actual successor that he supposedly designated, and then you had the Sunni-Shia split. So if you go to Oman, for example, where I recently went, they're Ibadis, right? They're kind of, they converted while Muhammad was alive. So the Islam that they subscribe to is different from the Saudi Arabian and the Iranian Islam. Those are doctrinally different things. And you have the same split in Buddhism where you get Hinayana, Mahayana, all that from the early Buddhist adopters like Sri Lanka and Burma versus later adopters like Japan and China, right?
You, it's you just get these- the blind man and the elephant thing, really, you know, and everybody is, all of our experience is subjective. We all just have subjective experience. It comes through our senses. And we have to trust our senses that we're getting an accurate portrayal of the real world. And some people have distortions that are, you know, you may have a distortion because you're schizophrenic or, you know, you have various things that can go on in the mind that can distort that perception. But it's inarguable that everybody's perception is going to be to some extent different from everybody else's. And inevitable that there would be different approaches that would emerge to, I mean, you could all be looking at the same thing and see it differently, you know?
No, but that's exactly, that's art and that's meaning, but not phenomena. Phenomena doesn't have, see the thing that's interesting.
I'm saying phenomenologically, there is, well, we don't really know this though. I assume that there is this external reality and that it is what it is, regardless of what my perception is. But right. I have only my perception to go on.
Well, no, you don't. No, you don't. This is the beauty of science, right? So what science, think about the visible spectrum. Why do we say the visible spectrum? Because our particular eyes are only designed to track a very, very small segment of the massive electromagnetic spectrum. But what have we done? We've created instruments that use that can detect the other parts that we can't see, right? Subatomic. Well, none of us have ever seen a subatomic particle, let alone an atom, let alone molecules. I mean, now we have electron microscopes, so we can see some of that. But the whole scientific endeavor is to get past the limitations of the human brain. I mean, my favorite example of that is gravity, just basic gravity. The first theory of gravity, which Galileo created or discovered through the scientific method, he dropped objects from the Leaning Tower of Pisa, right? I mean, and he disproved something that Aristotle had said 2,000 years earlier, and everybody else had believed because it seemed intuitively true that heavier objects would fall faster, right? Because we don't live on the tops of trees anymore, and evolution hasn't given us that particular piece of code. So human beings don't have a very good understanding of vertical gravity, like objects falling. And so even today, me as a human being, if you say, okay, I dropped this bowling ball and I dropped this tennis ball, which one's going to fall faster? And I'm going to still say the bowling ball, right? But that's because my particular human brain is wired a certain way. But once I know science, I can go, oh, that's funny. That's my brain tricking me, because we know through science and the repeated use of the scientific method, including the hammer and the feather drop on the moon, right, that gravity operates uniformly. So that's what's so interesting to me about this, is that the scientific method is transcending human senses and going beyond, much, much, much further beyond what the human eyes can see and we can feel, taste, and touch. Whereas to me, Buddhism and other personal philosophies of how to deal with the world are all about sort of like, but even within Buddhism, it's, oh, how do I transcend my particular, right, my particular wants and needs, right? How do I actually get past that, right? When Gautama's son was born, he said, ah, attachment. He noticed his own attachment. And he was the first psychologist, right? He was the first psychologist who understood the human brain is wired for certain things, but that those things don't make it happy. It doesn't make it satisfied to live a life. And he began to investigate in his own lab with himself and then with his all followers and everybody else, like, what are the keys to this happiness or this joy of life, right? And he started to propose things that today we scientifically know are true because psychologists have run these experiments that he ran personally, right? So we have like different ideas of happiness and joy, things like that, that absolutely conform with what Buddha was talking about, but we verified it through repeated uses of the scientific method, right? So that's where this whole thing starts to become, I think, interesting, is do you actually say, well, what I can experience is true? If you fall on that sword, then that's all you're left with is your personal experience. And that's where the cult leader can get you, because they can then use very tricks that of the human brain and the human mind to get you down a path, right? Versus, no. We have to go verify these things through this other method that might or might not conform with how we think the universe works. The reason Einstein failed in his second half of his life, I mean, again, to say Einstein failed is even laughable, but I just mean in terms of missing the quantum revolution, is because he personally couldn't get past the idea of this random world that lived there, right? He couldn't get there, but science got there. Science passed through these realms of what the human being thought was true or should be true.
Yes, and I don't think that it's controversial to observe that some belief sets leave one more or less vulnerable to the cult leader to move in. And one of the things that I appreciate about the particular flavor of Buddhism that John describes is that it, by managing the internal relationship with the experience of, for example, the virus, the pandemic, it does not create a context where someone is likely to then go creating false meaning out of conspiracy theories, right? Because it creates a context for sustainable internal management of that experience and kind of keeps itself in its own lane. It says, actually, this is about how you experience this, not the kind of fundamental externality truth of the matter, which I think is the pitfall that can be fallen into by many belief sets, including Buddhism, just not the species of it that John is articulating.
Yes, and exactly. And so just to speak about John as if he's not here, but to me, what...
I may not be here.
But you're not here. You're here. You are here. So no, the thing that's interesting is that I think you're discounting John, the scientific aspect of your particular internal construct that is based on the scientific method. You're discounting that, and you might be overvaluing the Buddhist part of it. But I think they both cooperate and coexist in your particular framework in a way that is actually very, you know, it's not that Buddhism is telling you how the universe works. You're actually relying on science for that. But Buddhism is telling you how you should relate to the fact that COVID is a reality, and what does it mean, and what can we take from that, and how do we learn? Those are two different things, and it's because you bordered that, right? Like, the claim that everything is connected is not interesting. Like, let me just hold off for a second. What I mean by that is it doesn't tell me anything particular. What science does, it says, okay, let's examine how everything is connected and what are the forces that make connect everything, right? So making the claim that everything is connected that Buddhism claims, or some aspects of Buddhism claim, is not an interesting phenomenal, it's not a very high bar of phenomenal kind of claim. Like, okay, yeah, intuitively everything's connected, right? What that concept and that model is doing is saying to you, what happens when you see everything is interrelated, and how do you relate, not just as a selfish, unique being running around, but interconnected with other human beings and with the environment and with the world and so on and so forth. How do you now reapproach your life, right? And your actions of your life. That to me is the part that concept gives you, the purchase of that gives you. It doesn't give you what is the mechanism by which everything is connected, and how can I explain it and reproduce it, understand it.
Okay, we're pretty far along. We probably should wrap up in a minute, but I want to read a quote to you. And it's this. We were speaking of beliefs and conditioning. All belief possibly could be said to be the result of some conditioning. Thus, the study of history is simply the study of one belief system deposing another, and so on, and so on, and so on. A psychologically tested belief of our time is that the central nervous system, which feeds its impulses directly to the brain, conscious and subconscious, is unable to discern between the real and the vividly imagined experience. If there is a difference, and most of us believe there is, am I being clear? For to examine these concepts requires tremendous energy and discipline. To experience the now without preconception or beliefs, to allow the unknown to occur and to occur, requires clarity. And where there is clarity, there is no choice. And where there is choice, there is misery. And why should anyone listen to me? Why should I speak? Since I know nothing. Recognize that quote?
No, that's, but I love it.
That's the Swami sitting in the steam bath in the movie Head, featuring the monkeys. And that screenplay was written by Jack Nicholson. So I suppose that's actually a quote from Jack Nicholson.
The Swami speaks for Jack. I mean, there's so many things I disagree with. There's so many things I disagree
you
with in
the
that
Swami.
Statement. Well, I'm a ghost Swami. That's what I believe. Go, go,
that's
go.
That's for sure. Go, Swami, ghost.
No, I mean, the thing is that I just disagree with this idea of wanting to perceive the universe without my models. I mean, it's because I work so damn hard at refining and continually remaking and making my own internal models cohere and improve, that my experience of the universe is what it is. And I will tell you that my experience of the universe is extremely joyful, right? Like even the things we're going through now, I see in a construct of, this is America learning about its dark side. It's America exposing through this person all of its hidden problems that it doesn't want to deal with. And so on that point, I'm very grateful for what's happening right now politically, right? So my point is that I think it's actually because I continually work on my personal internal models across all these realms that my experience of life is what it is. And I have never employed, you know, other, in the end, I don't rely on any one model. Like, I'm not an ist of any kind. I'm not an estist. I'm not a Buddhist. I'm not a Christian. I'm a Bejoyist. right? It's that I relied on my own continual curation of my models that then allows me to, when I'm in the world, those models are what are operating. Those models are helping me to interact in a way that I find very nice and good, pleasing, let's say. So like that's sort of where I really disagree with Buddhism. If you want me to sort of like say it explicitly, it's, oh, I have no models and I'm just perceiving. I'm like, no, you don't. You are using the complete set of all of your models, both biologically and personally curated, to experience the world. And it's the continual working of that. Like if you didn't need to work on that, then why are people meditating for years and not getting there, right? You have to work on that through some set of methods to then have this experience of life that is pleasing or joyful.
And with that, we probably should conclude. But I will point out that we still have not started a cult. We have work to do.
Speak for yourself. I have the First Church of Scoop meeting every week here. My many followers, which are mostly squirrels and deer here at the Magic Kingdom, will disagree with everyone. So come on down and I'll convert you.
Item one, I'll attend Scoop, let me know. Item two, I'd like a construction sign, no injuries since day for this group, which is days since a cult was created. Let's just see how high we can get to the number.
Well, gentlemen, thanks. And we hope that you will continue to be part of the Plutopia News Network and join us again soon.
You can stay in touch with Plutopia at plutopia.io. On Facebook, look for @PlutopiaNews. On Twitter, it's @Plutopia. With John Lubkowski, I'm Scoop Sweeney. This is the Plutopia News Network, 20 minutes into the future.